Welcome back to Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach. This is the final episode for Series 8 of the podcast, and it's an incredible one to end on. Stacey Heal is a fashion academic, campaigner, and writer. When their youngest daughter was a baby, they discovered Stacey's husband, Greg, had terminal cancer. Greg died 5 years later. Stacey's memoir, Now Is Not the Time for Flowers, is a look at all the big conversations that arise from imminent death. It's the story of modern womanhood told through the lens of grief and loss. It's also very, very funny. Stacey and I talk about writing about the dead, the upsides of social media, eschewing the typical narrative memoir structure, and writing about the funny side of death. Now Is Not the Time for Flowers is out tomorrow, March 28th. It is absolutely incredible. That's it for the current series. Don't forget that Not Too Busy to Write is now over on Substack, and the writing conversation continues over there while the podcast is on a break and I get on with some writing myself. All the links are in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. Stacey, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, Penny, thank you so much for having me. It's a joy.
I messaged you. I only read the book very, very kind of recently because we had trouble kind of getting a copy. And I read it very quickly over the weekend, sort of inhaled it over the weekend. And I was sending you messages because I knew it was going to be good, Stacey. I knew, right? I love what I've read of yours online. You send me gorgeous messages that are really insightful. And I love how your brain works. But I was actually quite overwhelmed with how incredible this book is.
Thank you. You're the second person to read it in the world.
Well, I mean, what a huge privilege. It is just the most incredible exploration of grief and love. And it's really interesting because I know it's about your experience of your husband's illness and death. But it's not really about your husband. It's really about you and your experience of love and grief and how everything gets tangled, both the joyous and the difficult and everything, every emotion. And I laughed and I cried, and it was just, it was such an incredible experience. But what I wanted to begin with, I just needed to tell you that straight off the bat.
Oh my God. No, please, that you can't, well, as a writer yourself, surely you will know like what that means. To have spent, especially when you're writing about yourself and your own life and some things that are so important to you and personal, you know, to hear that kind of feedback is literally everything. It's literally everything. Well, so thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, what I wanted to start with, you write in the book, quite near the beginning of the book, about finding out when Greg was still alive that you were going to write a book and that you had that conversation and how glad you were able to have that conversation with him. And I wanted to ask you about this idea about writing about the dead and whether you felt like you needed his permission in some kind of way, or whether or not, if that it's happened much later after his death that happened, was there any part of you that worried about writing about it? Or because this feels to me like your story, not Greg's, very much, even though obviously he's a huge integral part of it.
That's a really good question, and that has been something that has been on my mind. I mean, when he was alive, we often had conversations about things that I would write about. There are some things that we spoke about that I knew I would never ever talk about, and I never will. We kind of had some agreements about certain things. And when I found out about the book, I mean, it was the bizarrest thing to have those conversations with publishers, with agents. It was surreal while Greg was dying. It was a very strange thing. And I didn't tell him to get permission. But I suppose afterwards, I realized what a gift it was in that sense to have been able to tell him. I told him because, as I said in the book, I wanted him to be proud of me. So much of our experience together, that like we both he worked in the creative industries. He was in a band. He was a published poet. He was a painter, an illustrator. He was all of the things. And I've always worked in the creative industries. So much of our joined lives were about creative endeavors.
Mm.
And I was always the one really who was a bit more shy about it. Or I didn't like put myself out there and say, oh yeah, I've curated an exhibition, so I'm a curator. And he would say, you are, you've got to say that.
Mm.
You've got to believe that in yourself. And I realized that in having those conversations, I realized really quickly that anything that ever happened to me again, I would never be able to tell him. And I always loved telling him things because he was always such a big cheerleader of mine and was always so happy for me. And that's a real lovely thing to kind of work in tandem with someone creatively, even though we had our different outputs, to kind of have that team, that joint team that was kind of cheering each other on. And it wasn't just an easy decision, actually, because, you know, it's a complicated thing. You know, someone's lying in bed, literally in the active process of dying, to be like, hey, guess what? You're dying, but I'm going to be a writer. Like, that's complicated. That's really hard.
It's really complex because it's something that's so future specific to you in a way that at that point he knew was not going to include him in terms of him being able to be there to witness it. It was
a very, very weird and complicated thing, but I'm really glad that I told him because I thought that would be the kind of thing that I will be sad about forever. And I was right, because there's been things that have happened since he's died, things that we've experienced or things that have happened to me that my first thought is, oh, I just wish I could tell Greg.
Mm.
I just wish I could talk this through with him. I wish he could know this. And that was a big deal.
Mm.
A big deal at that moment.
I wanted to talk to you about this idea of the shit Olympics because it was an idea that resonated very deeply with me. And I think from a couple of different aspects. One is that that first aspect, which is that when something very, very, very terrible is happening, in that moment, we often tell ourselves, well, this is it. This is the worst, right? This is the worst.
Mm.
And then unfortunately, you quickly realize that, oh, maybe it's not the worst thing. Maybe this is just one of the many crap things I'm going to have to live through. And maybe it feels the worst in this moment. I remember that feeling of after when my mom died, I had this feeling of, oh, that's it. It's the worst. We've been waiting for it to happen. And then, you know, the following year, 9/11 happened. And what I didn't realize, because I was in New York and I was there and watching it all happen, was that, oh, when a big trauma happens, a big grief happens, I'm going to re-grieve my mother. And that was like the first time I realized that unfortunately, when shit things happen, it doesn't mean that you get out of jail free card for the rest of your life.
I know. It's a shame, isn't it? It's a shame that life works like that. I remember very, very clearly, and I write about this in the book, that I remember thinking of being sat next to Greg in the hospital when he was first diagnosed, thinking, well, at least, you know, the silver lining of this is, like, at least I know, you know, the murderer has taken off the mask and revealed themselves. This is like, this is it. This is the lowest point. And I read, still in the hospital the next day, flicking through a newspaper, there was an article that was about a mother and a father, four young children. And the picture was of them in hospital together in separate beds that they had pushed together, and they were holding hands. And they had both been diagnosed with terminal cancer within a few days of each other and were both told, like, you've got months to live with four small children. And that blew my mind, because you kind of think, surely there has to be some kind of quota.
Yeah, like a quota.
A quota of pain or just utter shitness that happens to you. Like, it's just not, that's not fair. That's not enough. And it's that brutal realization of, like, yeah, none of this is fair. Fairness has got nothing to do with it. And it's not even worth discussing, because it's not in the, fairness isn't even, never pretended to be in the equation. But there's that feeling of having to then you've got, you're carrying that. So when other things come forward, you kind of, it brings up all that stuff again. Yeah. I was talking to someone the other day about that. They were saying about going to funerals and how funerals are never just about the person who's died.
Yes. Because yeah.
Every single person sat in the congregation is bringing with them all of their dead. It's this time that they're also really ruminating on those other deep griefs, and it's this little portal. I always think though, either the church or the crematorium, you walk in and it's this tiny little portal into the past and into the future, where your psyche vomits up all of your feelings about different things, maybe some things you didn't even realize you felt or thought, and you almost get to process it. And as you walk out, that's why I love a wake. I know that sounds strange, but I bloody love a wake, because when it's kind of, once you've gone through the actual funeral bit, you kind of walk out of the doors a tiny bit cleansed.
Yes. Yes.
It's
absolutely
like going through the fire yourself and then having to kind of come out and go, whoa, oh my God. And then there's this, there's a lightness at a wake that's kind of, people have kind of taken a little bit of something, they've processed something, and a little bit has come off their shoulders.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really incredible experience, isn't it? I remember actually my mum's was the very first one I'd been to that was someone close to me, you know, like somebody that I, you know, knew very, you know, deeply. And I remember that evening just thinking, oh, I totally get it now. I get why we do this. Like, it makes so much sense. All of this kind of cultural literature and film and everything about this process, I now kind of understood how you kind of physically need that process as a human. Yeah, it's, but also what everybody brings is something different to that, those spaces. Really incredible. And you write also about this idea of you being the widow in that experience, and how you got given a title and nobody else got given a title, not his parents who lost a child, and not his siblings. And in a way, not even your daughters actually got given a special title. You get given this special title, and how that one day that means something quite special. We get a front row seat, and but how afterwards the meaning of the word widow changes, and it doesn't. So can you talk to me about that experience of sort of being given that title that you didn't ask for?
Yeah, it's a weird one, because widow has some really big connotations that I think we all carry, whether we're aware of it or not. A widow could be seen as you know, the black widow, something that's quite kind of insidious or dangerous, or maybe the widow that will steal your husband. Or also it's the kind of feckless, emotionally unstable spinster in the corner who's going to live alone with her cat. There's like, none of these connotations are great at all. And I, especially when you're given that title, I was 41. And so that's a strange thing, because obviously people also associate widows with, old age as well. That's what people associate it with. And I think on that particular day, I really tried to almost ham up this idea of the widow. And I did that very much with my outfit for Greg's funeral. I think this was kind of part of the insanity of grief and how it worked out, because me, my family, and Greg's family all got COVID pretty much a couple of days after Greg died, all of us for the first time. And so all of us were ill. We had to change the date of the funeral. So I was kind of rattling around my parents' house where we were all ill, and I was ordering all of these huge black dresses and black veils and doing these fashion shows while I had COVID. And my mum was the one trying to go like, shall we tone this down a bit? And I was like, no, we will not. Listen,
we're going to do it my way.
Yeah, if I want to be a fucking widow, if I've got to do this, then I'm going to do it. And it was kind of my way, you know, I work as a fashion academic as well. It was kind of my way of processing things. And I was really aware that all eyes were going to be on me. I mean, not me exclusively, obviously, but I spoke at Greg's funeral as well. So I kind of almost thought it was a bit of a costume.
Yeah.
It was actually a bit of a costume because I had, you know, I also had on like black lace gloves.
That detail just to me, I'm so there with you on the costume thing. It's like armor in a way, isn't it? It's like dressing yourself for a very particular battle you had to face that day, and you needed clothes to suit it.
Yeah, I mean, and it was really obvious when I thought about it. It's like I bought the most ridiculously big black sunglasses, like crazy big. They almost covered 3/4 of my face, and I had a black veil as well. So it was full on. And I suppose it was this protection. It was this huge protection of like staying in my little bubble. Mm. I needed to be in my bubble. And I was really aware that it was a huge reverence towards me on that day. Mm. Which was actually very lovely. It was very lovely. I kind of felt the love. I really, really felt the love on that day towards me and what I had lost. But then obviously it's one of those things that get, I don't know. Widow is a very, very complicated title. And I'm aware that I get a title as opposed to, like you said, like anyone else in Greg's family, for example. And I wonder how that might make other people feel that, I mean, my grief is no bigger than anybody else's. And you're right, thinking about like my children, about what they have lost and how huge that is for them with no necessary kind of recognition. The problem with the term widow comes, I think, later, because I think there is some pity that people have that can be quite obvious when they're talking to you. I think there can be a lot of judgment. Huge. I know a lot of people who are widowed now just through kind of in community. And the things that people tell me about how people react to them, about how they go on to live their life, whatever that looks like, whether to do with moving house or what jobs they take on, or and the big one, relationships. Mm. What people feel that they have a very huge and important right to tell you what their opinions are of your relationship status. I personally haven't experienced that because I haven't been in a relationship at all since Greg died. But everybody, I mean, literally without fail, I would say every single person that I know who has been widowed at any age has had huge kickback from people about different ways that they've decided to live their life. And I feel rageful for them. Like, just if I think about my personal experience of knowing the level of pain and trauma of what it is to care for your partner and then to watch them die, and the pain that is left afterwards, especially with children, the fact that you're having to go through your own grief.
Parenting children who are grieving.
Children who are grieving, and where are you in all of that? I just think if anybody who has any judgment over any of that could feel that for an hour, I think they would take everything back and be like, do you know what? You deserve any pocket of joy you can find for yourself. Take it.
Absolutely.
And also it's that knowledge, isn't it, of like, there's nothing like death to really give you the wake-up call of that life is short.
Yeah.
And that none of us know what's around the corner. None of us know what new little pain in our bodies could turn into. We don't know when the next phone call is going to come. We've got no idea. So to think that we need to kind of live in the judgment of others is a waste of time.
Total waste. I totally agree. It's like just being a woman in general, obviously, we get all that anyway. And then becoming a widow, it's like it's that to the extreme, isn't it? That there's a particular way you're supposed to live as a woman, and there's a very particular way you're supposed to live as a widow. But I wanted to also talk about how you've structured the book, because it's not a chronological narrative, not a strict chronological narrative.
Mm.
You've structured it around themes, and we kind of move around a bit in time between Greg's diagnosis, his illness, his death, and then afterwards, and we move around between all these different states, looking at different themes of love and desire and motherhood and grief and all these different things. And I loved that. I loved that because I felt right from the beginning. I think part of the reason why I love that is because Greg is present throughout, rather than him being here and then not being here anymore. And I loved that. I loved that he was present. And I loved that you're looking at these things from the angle of all these different experiences of before and after, in a way. Was that really clear to you from the beginning that you needed to do it that way? Or was
absolutely
that something
not.
That had to kind of be mulled out on the page?
Oh my God, no, that was not what the book started off like at all. I think I started off writing it in a very, very chronological, I suppose kind of memoir-y grief memoir, kind of like, and then this happened and this happened and this happened. And to be honest, I was bored writing it. I was like, oh, yuck. Like, I don't want to write this, let alone who's going to want to read this. And what I realized was that there were certain things that were kind of coming out of the page at me that were sparking my ideas about other things that I've lived through. And so I had this enormous breakdown. That was probably about a year ago. I had this enormous breakdown, and I wrote this note to myself in my notebook. I write everything in notebooks first. And I wrote, I do not want to write this fucking book. And I was halfway through it. And I then sent these long, rambly voice notes to my agent, my publisher, going, I hate it. I hate everything in this book. It's not what I want. And I just wrote down, I think I wrote the sentence like, you don't know until you know. And I realized that that is the overriding theme.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of what I wanted to write about. It wasn't about, oh, here was my husband, and he was ill, and then he died, and here's my life. It wasn't that. I realized that there was a broader topic that I wanted mm-hmm. to talk about in all of it, which was this idea that we just don't know how anything will feel or how we will react in any situation until we are actually in it ourselves, and that we have an idea of how life will go, and it is so, so rarely that. And I start the book actually at school, when I was in my last year of school, and it was my very, very first experience of what I'm talking about, which was when me and my best friends are having lunch together. It's a couple of months before our GCSE. We're doing revision. And there's a rumor going around school that someone in our year has been pregnant and had an abortion. So we're doing the kind of whole girly over lunch chat, and it's all the usual thing of like, oh my God, how could she have let this happen? Oh, wow. Has she had an abortion? I could know if I got pregnant, I could never do that. I could never do that. And I then found out that I was pregnant probably no more than 2 or 3 weeks off.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was head girl at the school. And it was the sharpest realization that I knew nothing about anything, really. That kind of like teenage confidence of like, I know how the world works, which I had in abundance at that age. Oh my God. Yeah. And I knew immediately. I was like, there's no fucking way I can have a kid. I'm 16. I'm about to do my GCSEs. My boyfriend is a bit of an idiot, actually. Like, that's not what I want to do. I've got big plans for my, and it was immediate. There was none of this like, oh, I couldn't do that to my unborn child. It was like, right, phone the clinic. This is the decision.
You just knew immediately. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it was my real first understanding, like, one, yeah, life doesn't work out how you think it's going to. And be careful what you say about other people,
yeah.
or what you believe the judgment you have over other people's situations, if you have no concept of what that is like, mm-hmm. you don't know. You actually don't know until you're there. And I think that was I realized that that was a much more interesting book.
Mm.
It was much more, it's a lot of it is seen through my eyes and very much the lens of lots of different things that have happened to me over the years. But I wanted to talk more broadly about the experiences of women in this, about especially for women, how we are taught many different things as we're growing up, whether we take that in subconsciously. We're taught these different routes that we kind of think that we're going to go down. And yeah, like being pregnant as a head girl at 16 was definitely not one of them. And I think getting pregnant, having a baby, my second baby, and on that baby's birthday, your partner is told they have terminal cancer. That most certainly is not in the plan either. And I think it was a it was a huge revelation to me about how I then dealt with it and how that looked. And I think one of the big pushes for me to write certain things in the book was that I was angry that I didn't know, that people didn't tell, why don't we know this? Why don't we know what these things look like? And to give an experience that maybe more people listening could maybe understand, when Greg was actively dying and there were things going on physically that were really shocking in that they were new, I didn't know what was going on. And the nurses around were kind of going, oh yeah, 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 that's what happens when a body dies. And I'm like, what, really? Yeah. And I think about, imagine if pregnant women were not told, oh, after you've given birth to the baby, you're going to give birth to another organ. It's called the placenta. You're going to either have to contract it out of you as you did the baby afterwards, or it will also have to be taken out in a cesarean. Like, imagine not knowing that and how that would feel to suddenly go, oh my God, I've just given birth.
And I have to do what now? Yeah.
To an alien. And think about, for the people who have given birth, like what that was like. Imagine the shock of that. And it felt like that to me of like, why don't we know this?
Yeah. Like, why don't we understand death? Yeah.
We're all going to probably multiple times have to be around people who are dying. And then we're going
and
to have
kind
to
of
die
if
after.
We're lucky, right? If we're lucky, we'll live long enough, to see other people die. But yeah, that's the thing that's so interesting, isn't it? And I'm so drawn to, I've talked about this, I think, a number of times on the podcast. I'm very drawn to death lit. It was really interesting reading about how you went through a period where you were reading a huge amount about death.
Yeah.
And it's something I'm deeply fascinated by because, my mother's funeral was the first funeral really that I went to that I was sort of, a big part of. And this idea that there was this whole world of death that we don't talk about certainly in Australia, in the UK particularly, we don't really talk about very much. We're not very physically connected to. And this idea that other people have lifted the lid for us, it's such a gift. It is such an incredible gift, I think, as a writer to share that experience with others.
I think that was one of my huge aims, which was to find the balance between the respect for Greg, even though he's not here, of like, I didn't want to share things that were very graphic.
Yeah.
It's
not graphic. It's not.
Yeah. And actually dignity is a huge, huge thing that comes up in death. That person's dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And I most certainly didn't want to tap into any of that. So it was very much more about me, about how I was experiencing it through my eyes. And I wanted to write something that I wanted to read, ultimately. I feel like my big focus on this death literature, watching documentaries, listening to podcasts about death, was me trying to prepare myself and really try and not finding, or maybe I thought I'd found the thing of like, oh, okay, I kind of understand. I understand. And then when it got to it, I was, I don't know, just so shocked. It reminded me so much of birth in so many ways. Thinking about like when people talk about birth plan and about like write your birth plan about what you want, and then you basically have to throw that out of the window immediately and forget all about it and then just get on with the birth that you're actually going to have. It reminded me of that. And I feel like I was almost writing a death plan in my head of like, okay, so then this is going to happen. And then this is going to happen. And then this is what will, this is what it's going to look like. And it felt like every piece of literature I'd ever read was bullshit.
Yeah.
I was so angry, actually. And at the time, I'm not angry now, but people who write very prolifically about death, I read their books and it gave me a very safe sense of what death can look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that is what I experienced.
Mm.
And that kind of led me into a bit of a false security.
Mm.
I mean, it's a difficult thing to say because it's like, oh, would I want to know? Possibly.
Yeah.
Not. I don't know. It's really complicated, isn't it?
It's really complicated. But actually, what's interesting is that the way you approach writing about it actually really reminded me. I had Catherine Newman on the podcast. I don't know if you've read We All Want Impossible Things, but it's.
No, I haven't, but I know of it.
I just, when you feel ready to, I don't, depending on where your headspace is at about what you feel like reading. But it's about her. It's a character who's supporting her best friend at the end of her life, and it's over 6 weeks in a hospice. And it's, you know, she approaches it with a similar humor that you do, because, and that's actually something I think we really need to talk about. It is a very funny book. It is very funny.
Oh my god!
I mean, it's so funny, Stacey.
I am
it's so important.
I'm so thrilled that you have said that, because I must admit that was one of my really, really big concerns, because I was like, I do need to really discuss how funny so much of this is. And I really hoped that came across.
It is so funny. And what was interesting talking to Catherine Newman about it was that, you know, her book is it's fiction, but it's based very much on her experience of caring for her best friend at the end of her life when they were in their mid to late 40s. And she said that, you know, that was the thing that was a surprise to her about how absurd it all is, and how bodies, when they fail, when they're going wrong, some of it is really, really absurd and very funny. But you really capture that so beautifully. There's some really, really fabulous moments. I mean, was it when you're ringing the funeral director and you can't stop laughing when you're ringing the funeral director to book them? And just that idea of like, of appropriateness and emotion just kind of bubbling out all over the place in kind of what maybe other people see as inappropriate ways, which I'm sure those funeral directors are very used to, like completely.
Oh, I'm sure.
Very common.
I'm sure they've seen it all. One thing I also discuss in the book is the evening that we are all brought together at Greg's parents' house, where we are told like he has hours left to live. There's almost like a bit of a kind of sit-in downstairs while he's upstairs, and his like family and friends are all downstairs. Honestly, I could probably say it's one of the, I had some of the funniest conversations of my life in that evening, which is strange, because I was also more scared than I've ever been on that evening as well. Like it was like a terror that I haven't experienced before. But at the same time, some of the stories that some of like mine and Greg's relatives were like stories about the past, about other family members. I was in the kitchen, bent over double, crying with my legs crossed so I didn't wee myself. And I thought to myself, oh, maybe I shouldn't be laughing because what if Greg hears this? And I then thought, do you know what? I think if I was dying, I think I would want to hear the people I love laughing.
Maybe, and maybe it would be a reassuring sound to hear in the distance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I talk a lot actually about what I hope death is like. And I talk about how when you're a kid being taken home, if you've been out late somewhere with your family and being taken, maybe you're sleeping on a sofa while the adults are still in their evening, and then someone puts a coat over you, and then you're carried to the car, and then you're asleep in the car and they carry you into your bed. And just the safety, the incredible safety of that, of night, knowing you're safe to sleep with your family around you and you can hear laughter and fun going on through that sleep. And I truly hope that is kind of what death feels like, and that is how it felt to Greg.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh. I wanted to go back a little bit now to when you first started sharing more online and first started writing publicly about your experience, which was well before Greg died. And I wanted to ask you about social media, because I think, you know, we treat social media, which was one of your outlets, you also had a column as well. We treat it like, you know, I think particularly at the moment, it's a little bit trendy to kind of, you know, I'm quitting it's Instagram and it's all so awful and all this stuff. But I wanted to ask you about what social media meant for you at this particular time, where you needed to grow a community that did not currently exist around you when Greg received a terminal diagnosis initially.
Yeah, it came about really organically, because at that time when Greg was diagnosed, I didn't actually have any social media at all. None whatsoever. And it was actually through, we went to this workshop, a cancer workshop, and every single person there was at least probably 65 and up. And everybody, I was still breastfeeding my baby and I took her with us, and every single person in that room looked on us with utter pity. Not in a patronizing way, but like they were talking about, I just want to live a bit longer to have some more time with my grandchildren. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm basically feeding my baby in my arms here, and this is awful, and I don't know how to talk to anybody here about it. And it was like a lifeline to me. I did it because I would spend these huge days in hospital with Greg, where he was started having chemotherapy, and these drugs kind of have to be dripped into the body like so slowly, because they're ultimately like a poison. So he would kind of be in the chair 7 hours some days, and I would be alone in the hospital rattling around by myself. And I bought myself a notebook and I just started writing for myself, really. And then one day I wrote something and decided to restart my Facebook account that I'd had many years ago and share it. And it was a really big deal because it was quite personal. I was never that person that would like tell people lots of intimate details about things ever, really. And it was very personal, and the response I got was so huge and so heartwarming, because I was so alone. I was alone in this hospital, and Greg was kind of in his own head, as he absolutely had to be. Again, it's that kind of bubble where he was either asleep, or he was drawing, or he was reading. He kind of had to keep his head together, as he should have done. And it was almost like my little flare up into the sky to be in this place, huge, huge, expansive clinical hospital that was so terrifying to me. That hospital took on such a character for me of, it was honestly like walking into the gates of hell when we went there. Social media became this way of being like, hello, hello, is anyone here? And what happened is that as that, I kind of made that my weekly thing. So I did it once a week. So every time we went to the hospital, I would sit and I'd write something quite long about how I was feeling and what was going on. And I shared a picture of it. And as it went on, I had more and more responses. And then people started sharing it. And then people I didn't know started commenting. And someone said to me, you should join Instagram because there's a big cancer community on there. And the first person I met in the cancer world, in the weirdest situation, was Deborah James, our babe. We kind of met outside of that because we were both in contact with Bowel Cancer UK. And I suddenly became part of this world, which was like, oh my God, there's also young people. There's young people with children who also like fashion, who just a normal people who I kind of had all these things in common with. And then I started to really understand that there was community there. And I think when I first started sharing, it was very much about me. It was about the support that I needed. But as time went on, I realized that I could offer quite a lot to other people to kind of facilitate a community that could support others. And so I know that Instagram gets a hugely bad rap, but I even did a TED talk on it. My TED talk is about the power of social media in hard times and what a support network that can be. I have made true and real friends through Instagram, real life friends who I deeply love and rely on and have done for years. I'm same as the next person of hating all the algorithm utter nonsense on Instagram, but at the same time I can't argue with what it's given me, which is huge.
And it's
the reason why I got the book deal. all the publishers, the only place I had a newspaper column when I was kind of 2017-18, but I stopped then. It was for 2 years. But it was when I was contacted by lots of publishers, it was the only way they saw my writing was on Instagram.
Yeah. It has been such a powerful tool. And I think I also wrote about social media when in my last book and how important it became to me and how I could see it was important for so many communities. And I think, you know, interestingly, I think specifically for caregivers, because it's almost like, you know, something massive is happening to us, but at the same time, we are not the central person. Yeah. We are something's happening to the person that we love and that we have to support. But as a result, our whole entire life has changed because of that. And it's a very difficult position to be in because it's not all about you, but at the same time, your life is unrecognizable. And because of that, I found actually so many people found that social media was a way they could connect with other members of a community that they wouldn't otherwise be able to access, particularly younger caregivers, you know, where, you know, they aren't in their 60s and 70s and 80s when it's more, you know, quite common to become a caregiver at some point to a partner. But that access to each other can be such a lifeline.
It's enormous. It's absolutely enormous. And if you think about how many people will be a caregiver in their life and the kind of energy that you need for that in all different formats of like the physical energy that you need, the emotional, the psychological, I mean, it's endless. And I think that you need that kind of two-way street that Instagram or social media as a whole can give you of like a place to talk or vent or pose a question, and then what you can get back in terms of support. And I think that kind of cycle can be so important for people who are very isolated.
Absolutely.
Because they need to carry on ultimately, don't they? So you need, like, where are you getting your energy from?
Yeah.
And it's a great place to kind of top yourself up.
It is. Oh, I feel like I could keep going for hours and hours and hours. I cannot stress enough how incredible this book is. And
oh my God,
I just want everyone to read it. I feel like anyone who is curious about grief and about this idea that you articulated so beautifully before, this idea of like of sort of discovering all the things that we don't know until we know them.
Yeah.
I just want everyone to read it. It's just divine.
Oh,
and
God,
funny. Very funny. There's a whole scene. There's a whole scene with the psychic.
Oh, did you like that?
Classic.
Oh my God. Oh, I'm so glad.
Simon with his psychic spiritual guide, Liam.
What's
that all about? Yeah. That was brilliant.
Yeah. No, that's actually just one of my favorite chapters, actually.
Absolutely. Hilarious.
How ridiculous. I mean, that is, you know, you talk about moments that you wish that I wish Greg was alive for. That's probably the top one. Literally, that's probably, I'd rather him, yeah, if I had to pick a day, it wouldn't be like the book launch. It would be, I wish you could have sat next to me in that psychic weird room in like what could only be described as like a student let. And heard what this man was saying about him. I wish he could have been there because it would have been so, I mean, as funny as it was, it would have been funnier with him next to me.
But also, I mean, the fact that somebody you hadn't seen, and was it somebody you hadn't seen in a very long time had gifted you that experience?
Yeah. It was
also, on
it
top
was
of
a very
else, hilarious.
It was, do you know what? It was a lovely gift. It's a lovely idea. It was a generous idea. And actually it worked out well because I got to write a chapter of the book about it.
It's true. And you know, what a hilarious, absurd experience. Thank you so much for chatting with me today. And everyone,
such a pleasure.
Go out and buy the book. Brilliant. And you can find Stacey on Instagram. Still the best place for you to find you.
I'm at Stacey_Heal. And my book, we haven't said the name of the book. It's called Now Is Not the Time for Flowers.
All of the links will be in the show notes. Thank you, Stacey, so much for being.
Oh, thank you, Penny. Thank you for saying so many lovely things about it.